It's time now for Alaska Tracks, an oral history of Alaska people and their way of life, celebrating the rich heritage, wild landscapes, and deeply rooted stories of Alaska past. Alaska Tracks, brought to you by Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware, Ginger Orem with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Mod Saw Shop. And now your host, respected wildlife biologist and outdoorsman, Randy Zarnke.
Hello again, listeners out there in Radio Land. This is Randy Zarnke with this week's episode of Alaska Tracks, a program where we listen to excerpts of interviews I recorded with senior age pilots and wildlife biologists and trappers and hunting guides. I started this project in 1997 and still record a few interviews every year. Today's featured guest is Herman Ludwigson of Wrangell. Herman's family moved to Southeast Alaska when he was just a boy. Herman took full advantage of the abundant natural resources in the area. He became a pilot and flew seemingly every square mile of the state over the next 46 years. But you don't want to listen to me. You want to hear Herman's stories. Let's get started.
Okay, Randy. Well, here we go. Been in Alaska since 1938. Come up to Alaska with my dad and our family on a small 36-foot troller from Seattle, where I was born. Come up to Ketchikan and was 9 years old. Been here ever since. Don't want to leave. Don't want the outside. Don't like to drive outside. In fact, anything south of Ketchikan is foreign. I don't like it. My dad and family were fishermen. They took me along when I was a young fella, and I learned how to troll and catch halibut and all the good stuff, and shoot eagles and shoot seals, which was legal then, of course. So you get $3 for the feet for the eagles and $6 for the seal nose, but nowadays we don't talk about that, so we'll pass that off. I went with my brother Arnold. This was in 47, 48, somewhere back in there. We each had a trolling boat, and we went back over to Chomley, where Norman Olson lives, him and his wife Harriet. And we tied up to him, and we anchored in a small harbor, which he calls Babe Island in Chomley, outside of Kitcoon Harbor. And I was just a young fella anyway, and that was an adventure, going out with your boat anchored up and going trapping in the middle of the winter. And my brother Arnold and I had a lot of mink traps, a lot of marten traps. And we didn't try for otter in them days. They were tough. They're tough to skin, tough to stretch, tough to turn, and the mink and marten were so much easier that it was just a lot better. And then the prices weren't that bad in them days. But to get the story going in the right direction, when we were all tied up there in Chomley, waiting for the season to open on the trapping, usually early November, once they started getting prime, where there was always a boat coming in there, low green, ugly looking boat, like everybody knows a fish pirate would look like, you know, trying to hide some from everybody. In the 30s and 40s, the territorial fish and game had transplanted marten on Prince of Wales Island. There was none on that island. They were not natural to the island. So they had transplanted them there. And they took off just crazy. So they finally opened the season on these marten. But before they opened it, we were there trapping. And this guy on this boat, this black boat, he was a poacher. And he was smart. He's dead and gone, and I don't think the name would hurt anybody. Rastus Brown on the Islander. And he had the fish and game so fooled they could never catch him. But he was trapping on all these bays in Southeast or in Prince of Wales Island, and nobody was trapping marten then, so he had it made. And he was taking them to Canada. He was going down to the Nass River by the village of Nass and Port Stewart and selling them, making good money. My brother Arnold and I, we did pretty good trapping. Of course, the beach runs with a skiff and a 10-horse kicker usually, putting around the beach there, and that when the days went outboard. I don't think anybody now would even remember the name, but Scott Atwater, Dandy Motor, way before their time. We did pretty good. We had over 100 mink marten one season. The next was, what, 90? Just living with Norman and Harriet on our boats in Chomley there, and we would have our Thanksgiving dinner. We'd go out and shoot our own, get a couple of mallards or a goose, and we'd have our own dinner.
Now, was this before they had built their home?
Yes, this was before. We were all in boats in the harbor right out in front there where he's got his big workshop. And the howling winds, and we had to put shorelines out four different directions to keep from blowing ashore from one direction to the other, because in those bays, the williwas would come from any direction at any time at night, and we didn't want to get beached. But we operated that way pretty well, and there was a lot of other fellows in that area trapping, Del Richardson and a few other guys that were trapping mink. We each had our own areas. You put out your trap line signs, trap line so-and-so in 1945, 46, and they'd honor them. But we had a few guys that would come in there, and you could hear them at night, pit lighting. They were shooting mink. You could call them up when you roll along the beach at night. I've done this. I didn't shoot them, but I've done this. You go out at night and roll around in your boat along the beach at low tide, and you could see the mink's eyes, little green eyes, running along the beach. Well, you could squeak your lips like you're squeaking for a dog, and they come running right to you, and you could pop them. They'd use a little 410 shotgun, and it wouldn't hurt them too bad. The fur buyers were pretty cautious. Norm Goldberg was one of the buyers that stopped through Ketchikan, and he knew. Once you dry it on your stretcher boards and then you turn it back inside out to the fur out, by then most of the pellet holes are gone. So what these guys would do, now I know a lot about this stuff, but when the skin was wet yet, they tell me that they would wash it in felsnap to soap and it would dissolve the blood and sort of close up the hole. And then once you dried it, as long as you didn't stretch it too hard, it wouldn't open up. Goldberg, he would peel back the bottom lip once it was dry. He could look into the nose part and the eye part, and you could see pellet holes sometimes.
So when he came through, I imagine he was here for a few days?
Yeah. Well, it was like Dillingham's Beaver Roundup. They knew Goldberg was going to be in town, and he'd stay at one of the local hotels. People would bring in their big gunny sacks full of fur. Some of them had them on big strings, drag them up to the hotel, right up into the lobby in the Goldberg's room, and lay it out there.
And then I imagine that when you get all the trappers together and they had a few bucks in their pocket, there would be a few stories.
There was a few of those, yes. Being the young fella that I didn't get into those too often. I was too busy chasing girls.
Okay.
Had my own troller for a while, did some fishing on my own, and had a good time. Of course, young fella, didn't really pay attention to the bills and charging of everything. Jim Weber came out of the Army from the States and started a small flying school in Ketchikan, called it Weber Air, and he had a bunch of small Luscombs and a Ronca sedan, and I worked for him as gas boys. They taught me how to fly. In them days, in the 40s, we'd run our own trap lines with those airplanes. We had a good time trapping mink and marten and a few otter, and chased a few wolves on the frozen lakes in Southeast, and we'd shoot a seal when it was legal and drop it in the pontoon as we were flying by an open lake. Within a week, 10 days, or whatever the cycle that they run, the wolves come by and we could get one or two shots out of the airplane from a shotgun. Never did get one, but we had a lot of fun doing it. Then we really got involved in trapping. They had a Super Cub there, which you guys up north know all about those things. Ours was on floats. We didn't have skis, wheels down here. We can't have those. We did a lot of wolf trapping. I think I had a little over 50 wolf traps, the 114 and number 4, Newhouse. And we'd shoot seals and fly out to these different inlets and bays and make sets, all saltwater sets down here for us. And we did pretty good. There was 2 or 3 guys in Ketchikan that did that. I'm still upset with the state. They owe me for 9 wolf bounties that they never paid. They run out of money, they said, and they just wouldn't pay me. We sold the wolf hides anyway for $50 a piece. And we did a little otter trapping. Well, we had the wolf traps out. I'd run up in the brush a ways and set a few marten sets. Never did bother with mink if the price wasn't good enough, but the marten were good. We had good marten there, on Prince of Wales Island especially. It was fun.
How about the wolf set that you'd prefer?
The wolf set were saltwater sets, and we'd make them just about 3/4 tide on the high tide mark where the water would come over and wash the human scent away. We would make a 3-trap set with a pyramid of rocks out in the pool, which was usually about 6 or 8 inches of water, and then we would anchor the trap with a long chain to a piece of heavy driftwood, something that looked natural to the beach. And when the wolf got in there, why, he would take this wood drag up the beach a ways and get hung up in the brush, and we'd come by and pop him with a .22 Magnum.
What was your bait? Was that seal?
Always seal, and the rottener the better. I got a weak stomach when it comes to that stuff. I mean, we'd have it in a barrel and we'd go in there with a gaff hook and reach it out and put it in a gunny sack and tie it to the floats on the outside of the airplane. Boy, that stunk. And the reason for the salt water set is because when your seal covered up with heavy rock, the wolf couldn't move it. To find these little dinky rocks with seaweed growing on them, smaller than the palm of your hand, and set them all around the trap so the seaweed would float in there. And the wolf can't see that trap. You find some little dinky little rock with seaweed growing on them. You put it all around the pan, disguise everything that way, but don't get caught. The seal meat was so rotten, and the juice from that little pool of water would make a little trail down to the lower part of the tide level. And if a wolf wasn't actually running the beach by the timber line, why, he would be following the water line, and he'd smell that trickle going through the water, going down into the salt water. And then he would follow that to your set. But your set always had to be facing, so the wolf would come into your set facing the woods. They don't like to walk into a set with their back to the woods. They want to be able to see their escape route. With the marten sets, the smell and the seal, they would smell that too. We would use seal blubber and nail it to the tree and make your marten set on a lean pole so the marten's got a little trail he can run up to it and make your set there. And then about 2 feet above that, we'd staple or nail some seal blubber or meat or duck feathers are good. Also, I never done it, but I was told that you can burn the feathers, and that smell attracts marten for a long distance. But I've had the marten come to some of these sets of mine where I'd rub the seal juice on the tree above it, and they eat the bark. They think that's good eating, so if they want to eat it, have at her. The Army rescued me. I was drafted in 1950. I went up north to Fairbanks and trained. The Army realized that I did know how to fly and they had some experience in the outdoors, so they sent me TDY to Bethel for the 2nd Scout Battalion training. They had an airplane there that was a 195 Cessna. I maintained the airplane for a captain that was flying it, and we would fly out to all the villages on the Bering Sea coast, out to Nunavik Island, the Quinnahawk, Kipnuk, and Kuguilnuk, and the Hooper Bay and Chivac, all those villages we'd visit up and down the Yukon too, and they'd drop me off and I'd stay a week or so, depending on the weather, and train the scouts, give them basic training. They knew more about it than we did, though. They were good rifle handlers and smart people. Those guys knew the survival, and that was the idea of getting them into the 2nd Scout Battalion. And Colonel Marston, Muktuk Marston, was involved in the 1st and 2nd Scout Battalion, mostly the 1st up in the Nome area. I became a staff sergeant in the Army, and I decided that my retirement date was coming up in 2 years, so I left. I didn't think the Army was going to be a home for me. As I was in Bethel, I met a young lady there. Her father owned a roadhouse and grocery store and dance hall, typical out in the tundra thing. They called it the Tundra Shack, a guy named Max Lieb. I met his daughter while I was there in the Army, and when I got discharged, she came down to Ketchikan, and we got married and raised a family.
I really appreciate Herman's low-key style. He could brag about all of his adventures, but that's not his way. Let's take a break here for a few words from our sponsors. Thanks to those sponsors who make this program possible. Now back to our interview with Herman Ludwigson of Wrangell.
Started flying down to Ketchikan for Weber Air. I flew for Ween Airlines out of Fairbanks in 56. Out of the dew line, co-pilot in 46s. I didn't stay long for that, so my father-in-law called me back to Bethel, and we bought an airplane and started our own service there in Bethel. Then I started flying all over the state. I was hired by Standard Oil to fly a gravity meter survey all up and down the coast, clear down to Port Hyden, Port Moeller, based out of King Salmon then. And Shell Oil hired me then for a couple seasons to fly them out of Bethel and then on the North Slope. I spent a couple summers up there living in tents on the Sag River and Chandler and Peters Lake and supplying the geologists with their helicopters for gas and food, and I'd go to Fairbanks and pick up their mail and fresh produce and can bring it back and land at the camps. And we lived in tents up by Eagle, by Woodchopper, Miller's Camp, and up the Porcupine River. We stayed up in there for a couple of weeks and then moved back up to the slope and went over to Peters Lake and Schrader Lake and Chandler Lake. Lived on all these lakes with these guys for summers and had a good time.
Do any fishing?
Yeah, I caught some nice Arctic char and seen some beautiful wolves up on the Porcupine. A helicopter pilot took me up one day and we flew out towards Vundick Lake. It's up above Fort Yukon on the Porcupine, quite a ways up by the border. and some pure white wolves. I mean, they were beauties. There was a female that looked like a lady, and she had some pups, and there was other ones, but there must have been half a dozen pure white guys up in there, and they were beauties. I wish it was trapping season, but there again, that's interior, and it's altogether different trapping for me, so I didn't bother.
And you must also have seen lots of moose.
Yeah, living at Miller's camp up the Yukon above Circle, a helicopter pilot had come in and landed before we had our camp set up and sat down there and was with one of the geologists looking for a base camp. And then moose charged him. He had to get the helicopter out of there. And we went up to see Henry Biederman up at Eagle. He stayed up there for a while. And then Shell Oil said, well, let's go from Eagle at the Canadian border and fly clear to demarcation point. Follow that straight line across the state to clear up to the Beaufort Sea. Went along there for a while, and then we landed in Flaxman Island, which is right outside of Prudhoe. In them days, these geologists knew there was something under the ground because they were doing all their good stuff. And a few years after that, why, everybody was staking oil claims up there, or acres and acres for 25 cents an acre. And hell, I was sitting on it. I didn't even know it. I would have been a millionaire today. I wouldn't have to talk to you guys. But they were closed-mouthed. They weren't supposed to tell me because I lived with them for years. We lived at Umiat. That was our base. I go to Umiat, too, and land in the lake there or in the Colville River and operate out of there on floats.
So you pretty well covered that whole northern...
Yeah, up to Noatak and all the way down to Cape Lisburn, and did a lot of flying up in the interior. Never did meet Andy Anderson at Bettles. Talked to him a few times. In fact, I called Andy on the phone here about a month ago. He wrote a nice book, Arctic Bush Pilot, I think they called it. Jim Reardon out of Homer set it up for him, and I read that, and I called Andy and asked him how things were going with that, and he lives in Pennsylvania. And he said, Herman, I'd love to come back to Alaska, but he's stuck on a farm. But I called Andy because I wanted to write a book of my own about all the stuff I had done up in the interior and in southeast. Once I got done with Shell Oil up in the North Slope and all over that country, I came back to Bethel and kept my own flying service going. I had two airplanes. Then this Eskimo kid I had hired didn't fare too well. He took one of my new airplanes out and crashed, lost his life. The state wasn't too happy with me about that, so they jerked my ticket for a while, and as far as an air taxi certificate. So I went to work for Northern Consolidated Airlines, flying with Jimmy Hoffman and Ray Peterson's outfit out of Anchorage. And we flew UC-78s, the bamboo bombers, floats, wheels, and skis, up and down the Yukon, Kuskokwim, same old stuff, up as far as Unalakleet, Macquarie, Cooper Bay, Chivac, all the scheduled runs. Didn't do too much trapping there, though. I left that up to the Eskimo guys. I flew a lot of them out to their trap lines and their fish nets and fish set. We stayed with Northern Consolidated for almost 2.5 years, flying their bamboo bombers. And then we got into the Pilatus Porters, the Swiss-built airplane that Wayne had a couple, I guess, and Northern Consolidated had five of them. And then decided that time to come home to Ketchikan.
What time frame are we talking?
Came back to Ketchikan, I think, in 65, and started flying for Weber Air. And then we got into trapping again. That's when we got heavy into the wolf trapping. I got over 215 wolf. As you can see, looking around my house, you see wolf pillows and wolf skulls and wolf rugs and wolf gloves over there in the wall and all kinds of things that reminds me of what we did. That was fun, wolf trapping out of the Super Cub. And also, I made a lot of sets with you guys up north from the interior, familiar with the Wolverine, a pretty smart guy, and I got into that a little bit too over in the mainland behind Ketchikan on Richard Bay, and I used a 330 Conibear, good set. It killed them instantly. Once they stuck their nose through there, it whapped them hard, and it was a humane set. I used seal meat again, and some other stuff I used that worked really good. And I got it from the States, from some guy that had a magazine about fishing stuff, and they called it Chad and Cheese. God, that was good stuff. Humongous smell. Boy, that was something.
And you just stuff a little bit of that in
way back
hole.
In the covey, underneath you leave a good-sized log that's leaning out right next to saltwater. Put a few rocks around the covey so that he couldn't get through the right. Sides, and then install this 330 Conibear right in front of the hole, and then cover it with a little bit of moss around the edges. And on the two triggers that stick down, we'd go up on the beach and find this hollow grass and slip grass over those two triggers. It was wintertime, and they were dry, but there would be a little bit of grass hanging from it, and it made a damn good set. It worked good. I got 9 Wolverine that way. But I had one in Roger Bay that he's still there today. He knew me, and I knew him, and he knew exactly what I was doing, and a lot of the fellows that trap those things know that every time he came to my set, he would spring it, I don't know how, get the bait, come out of the set. He left his calling card, what we call droppings, always right there by the set. So I tried to get smart as I could, so I got a jump trap, and I boiled it. Always wear gloves, never touched it with human hands. I put this Oneida jump right in front of the 330 Conibear. I buried it into the ground just below the entrance, and I put it in plastic bag so it wouldn't freeze into the ground. And mossed as much as you could. You couldn't tell it was there, but he knew it. He'd spring that sucker first, and I just never did get him.
Well, sometimes it's nice to know.
He can outsmart you, and this bugger was smart. I'm glad to this day that I didn't get him, but I would like to have. I didn't dread going back to that set, but every time I come to that set, no Wolverine. We're going back to the wolf trapping days with Weber Air Days and a Super Cub. I went down to a Boca de Quadra, one of the long arms they call a mink arm, and I was making a wolf set down there. I had the Super Cub almost a mile away from where I was making a wolf set, way up in the flats. I was almost done with the set, and I heard a wolf's howl. It was a steep ravine valley on both sides, a narrow head of the bay, and I could hear wolves howl on one side. And then someone barking and howling on the other side. They were talking back and forth. And this was real early spring, probably March. And I howled, because I was good at that. And I could call wolves, talk to them. And I'd howl and they'd bark and I'd howl and bark. So it went on for about 10, 20 minutes and pretty soon no noise. So I went out in the middle of the mud flats and I got down in a little hole in a muck. And I hunkered down in there, and I had borrowed a rifle, and it was a 30-30 octagon barrel old-timer, and 7 or 8 shot in the magazine. And no noise, and I thought, I wonder what's happening. When you're laying there in the mud, and you get to thinking somebody's watching you, I slowly turned my head around to look behind me, and here comes 7 or 8 wolves on a dead run, and they were less than 100 feet from me, because when I peeked up over the hump, and here they were. And their tongues were hanging out, just slobbering and running like old get out. And hell, they were right on me. And I thought, man, I'm dead. I thought, this is the end of it. So I grabbed the rifle, and I missed all the shots. I never hit a one. There were some beautiful wolves, and they went on both sides of me. And went on by up to the hill the other side. I never hit one. I know I wasn't shooting in the air. I wasn't hitting. I thought I was going to hatch. You know, looking at them that close in that pack. And that was close. It took me a while to get back to the airplane and fly home. When I came back home, I was pale as a ghost. She asked me, how come I'm so damn white? I had another one. I took a guy out trapping with me down there at the same bay named Ernie DeBoer, and he wanted a movie of a wolf in a trap. So I said, fine, come on with me. So we went down there, and here's a wolf in the trap. So I said, you get up there, Ernie, above the wolf, and I'll stay down here and kind of scoot him up the hill a little bit. And the drag got loose. And he was taking a movie with his camera, and all he could see is wolf getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And he screamed and dropped and run like, oh, get out. The wolf had got caught on the snag, you know, then finally I shot it. He thought he was going to get eat up, but more. He didn't ask to go anywhere. I was flying a 185 for Weber going up towards Whale Pass, and I had a woman passenger in the airplane, a lady named Georgia Brown. We were flying over a salt chuck lake. And I saw a wolf swimming across this lake. And I didn't have a gun. So I landed the airplane, and I taxied up alongside that wolf in the water. And I grabbed the axe. You always carry an axe in the airplane. And I hit that sucker with that axe. It's a wonder I didn't chop a hole in the float. He got to the beach, and he started running up the beach. So I rammed the airplane up in the sand beach and hollered at the woman, I'll be right back. And I grabbed that axe and went in the woods after that wolf. I never did find it, but she thought I was nuts. She was ready to get the hell out of the airplane. I don't blame her. I was chasing wolves on a lake with a Grumman one day, about 8 or 9 wolves out on a lake, and a Grumman's a pretty big airplane to be chasing wolves with, but this one guy in the back seat, he said, you're crazy, I'm never flying with you again. The otter. I tried those otter. I caught a few. You learn something about the otter If you have a coil of rope on a dock or a float on saltwater, an otter will come and poop on it. He'd go right to it. The otter will work a point down here where he can come out and see and look around, and he'll slide down into the water between the rocks. But you get up inside the timber the first 10 or so feet, and you can see where he's been sliding. Most of the time, they're sliding on their belly. And if you can catch him going over a log, he's got to stop and step over. That's where you put your trap, on the other side of that log. And if that didn't work, then you'd find when he comes up into an area where it's a little more level, and they usually level the ground. It looks like a little nicky park, and you find all their poop, and they usually go in different spots. And if you could be careful enough to take that away and cut a hole in the ground and put your trap down there and then put poop over it, if you were careful enough, they'd come and make their droppings there. But he would step with his hind feet. Man, they're wild. Oh boy, they're vicious. Hard to hold, and they're just a tiger by the tail. They're snarling and growling, and they're just like a wolverine. Man, they're ready to take you. I always carried a 22 Magnum long barrel, high standard, 9-inch barrel, and a shoulder holster to keep it out of my way so I can have my hands free for when I go into those guys.
Well, that's all the time we have for today, but tune in again next week when we'll hear more from Herman Ludwigson of Wrangell here on Alaska Tracks.
You have been listening to Alaska Tracks, a blend of interviews, storytelling, and firsthand accounts from Alaskans who know the land and carry forward the traditions of this remarkable state. Alaska Tracks has been brought to you by Ginger Orem with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding and Extreme North Trailers, Rod Saw Shop, and Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware. Join us next Saturday for another episode of Alaska Tracks, about Alaskans, for Alaskans, by Alaskans.